I'm Lisa DeLay, and you're listening to the Spark My Muse podcast. So welcome, everybody, to the Spark My Muse podcast. I have a special guest, Srini Rao, and he is a podcaster of the Unmistakable Creative podcast, as well as the Unmistakable Media Company. He is the CEO of that company, and he has just launched a book called Unmistakable, Why Only is Better Than Best. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, my pleasure.
And so before we get started into diving into the book a little bit, I was pretty curious as to some of the formative influences on your life growing up. What were some of the experiences that you think made you who you are today, whether it was family influences or religious influences or just sort of work ethic influences? What do you think shaped you the most?
I think it's probably, I would say religious or work ethic, because, I mean, early in my life, I had no work ethic. I didn't have the work ethic that I do now, for sure. But, you know, it depended, on certain things. Family influence was one. And then, of course, teachers, specifically like band directors, because I was in the band in high school. So that place actually is where I got my work ethic, but it didn't really translate into the working world. And, you know, I also come from, you know, an Indian family. So that definitely has had an influence in terms of some of the choices I made early on in my life, because social programming is actually one of those things that, you know, no matter how much we want to be as individualistic as we say we want to be, we're all impacted by social programming. Mm-hmm. And what's funny is, you know, so the ultimate, I always say the ultimate paradox of nonconformity is how many people are conforming to its ideals. you know, because at a certain point it actually becomes a form of conformity. So I've had, you know, I would say that, I mean, growing up, there isn't a ton specifically, but I would say, you know, I moved a lot when I was a kid. I went to a lot of different schools. So I think part of what shaped how I've ended up doing this work is because of that, I've always had this sort of deep desire to constantly be connecting to people and meet new people, because throughout my life, I was forced into situations where I had to make new friends, where I had to meet new people. Mm. So it's really not a coincidence that I've built a platform that endlessly connects me to new people. You know, it's one of those things, whereas, you know, a lot of people have platforms that don't facilitate that sort of deeper need. For me, I think it was just a natural extension of the thing that was most natural to me. So I would say that would be the biggest influence, is probably the fact that I, you know, was constantly moving.
And you find that invigorating, not like a fearful thing. You find meeting new people and getting new ideas is kind of like it.
Yeah, I mean, you up. Don't get me wrong. I crave, you know, I think as I've gotten older, I have started to crave solitude more. Like, I need it in order to do what I do. You know, like, I realize as a writer, you want periods of just, you know, intense solitude where you don't want to be interrupted by anybody, where you don't want connection. But I think that one of the things that's interesting about the online world that we live in is we have gotten this idea in our head that online is a substitute for real community and connection, which it's not. Mm. And, you know, we're starting to see some of the impact on that, because if, you know, your only sort of connection to the world is online, or, you know, friends that you have online, well, that's not really healthy. Mm-hmm. That I think is actually quite unhealthy. And so I think it's important that we have that. And, you know, the thing is we're losing so much of that because our lives are becoming increasingly digital. So something to think about, but yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a balance. I wouldn't say that it's, you know, something that invigorates me. Like, you know, I need both. Like, there are moments when I don't want anybody around.
Yeah. Well, and you're a big time surfer, and that's kind of, do you find that to be pretty solitude? That's kind of your quiet time, or do you find that to be more of a tribal kind of thing?
Well, it kind of serves both functions, right? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, when you drop into a wave and when you're riding a wave, it is absolutely a period of solitude because there's nobody else on the wave. But when you're in the water, you're talking to other people, you're talking to friends. So it's a combination of both. It's really weird because it's not one or the other.
Hmm. Yeah. And I think when you were talking, I've heard you in the past talk about being sort of nomadic, moving around because of your father's job. And I think that develops a lot of resiliency in your life. And it seems like you've bounced back from a lot of different things. And do you see that resiliency is also a theme in your life as well?
Yeah, it's funny you asked that. It's timely as well, because I'm writing a piece right now on recovering from failure, because I think that one of the things we don't understand about how to recover from failure is that the only way to really prepare yourself to recover from failure, probably the number one thing you can do to prepare yourself or learn how to recover from failure, is actually experience failure. Because how can you recover from something that you've never experienced?
Yeah, right.
But the thing is, we're so afraid of that. And, you know, if you've had the world handed to you on a silver platter your entire life, then you're going to have a very different experience of failure than, say, somebody who has experienced a ton of it and is used to falling and getting back up. So, yeah, I would say that absolutely resilience has been a theme throughout my life, because, and this is fresh in my mind because I was literally writing this before we spoke. I was making a list and I looked at it and said, the failure list is far bigger and far longer than the success list. And I think that you would probably find that to be the case with almost anybody who has achieved anything of significance. But you don't hear about the failures.
Right.
Because the success wipes out the failure.
That's so true. Yeah. And you think of people having an overnight success, but it's pretty much never the case.
No, it's not.
Yeah. Ugh. Well, one of the coolest lines, I think, in your book is that unmistakable work needs no signature. I love that. I love that. And your book is about why only is better than best. And maybe you can explain what that means in summary, so people can kind of get an idea of what you're targeting in your book.
Yeah. The core idea really is this, right? Is, you know, if it's unmistakable, like you said, it doesn't require signature, meaning that it's so distinctive that nobody could have done it but you, and it's immediately recognized as something that you did. And the value of that, of course, is it makes the entire concept of competition completely irrelevant. Because if nobody can do what you did in the way that you do it, then you can't find something to replace you. Nothing makes you replaceable. And that's very powerful in a world in which we are, finding that everybody has the ability to broadcast, everybody has the ability to publish, everybody has the ability to share ideas, which means the world is getting noisier and noisier, which means that attention is becoming more and more scarce. And as a byproduct, the attention is becoming more and more valuable. And as attention becomes scarce and more valuable, and we have more and more access to tools and technology and everything becomes democratized, that raises the bar significantly for what is expected if you are going to stand out in this world. Your work not only has to be at the highest quality that it can be, but it also has to stand out in an incredibly distinctive way. And I think that's really the core message of what Unmistakable is all about.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like people are sort of imitative at first when they're first getting started. Like, I know I started my podcast about 16 months ago, and I had listened to podcasts and I thought, where do I begin? And I begin with the ones that I like the best, and kind of not imitating them, but I guess being inspired, but you kind of don't know what your voice is yet in a way. Uh-huh. And then you're trying to figure it out, and then you're kind of getting your sea legs or whatever, and then you're sort of coming into your own unique flavor or something. But it seems like people who don't have an idea of what's unmistakable about them can veer off into a couple different directions. The one is like the shock, like I can be more explicit and more shocking than everybody else, and then everybody's sort of outdoing the shock value. Mm-hmm. Or they're just sort of ripping off somebody. You know, I see a lot of like ripoffs too, and it's not really unique and it's not really unmistakable, but they're trying to kind of do their own spin. And I guess the question is, how do people ever really know how to land on their unmistakable thing if they haven't really figured themselves out?
Well, I mean, part of the process of landing on the unmistakable thing is figuring yourself out, right? So I think most people don't get that, by the way, this isn't an overnight process. You know, if you might remember in the book, I said, you know, it took almost 4 years before we figured out what it was that made us unmistakable. Mm-hmm. You know, it was years of trial and error trying things. And so there's some value in imitation. There's no question to that. But I think the problem is that we imitate for so long, and we assume that if we keep imitating, we'll eventually get the result of the person that we're imitating. And not only that, we focus our imitation on one person as opposed to borrowing from multiple people. You know, I think Austin Kleon wrote this great book called Steal Like an Artist, and he makes a point to say, you know, don't just steal from one person, steal from multiple people. He said, you know, if you steal from one person, it's called plagiarism. If you steal from multiple, it's called research. And I think that if you look at what we do, you'll see that there are influences from, you know, every discipline, genre. I mean, we've also had one very big competitive advantage, and that is the fact that we've been exposed to so many people's ideas. But that's deliberate. I've made a point to go out of my way to expose myself to lots of ideas and lots of different ways of thinking and lots of different ways of looking at things. And if you keep changing the inputs that you are allowing into your life, if you keep diversifying your consumption patterns, you can't help but have that show up in your output. So that's what I would say is one of the keys. I think that patience is another one, right? We want this to happen really fast. We all want to basically start some sort of online project, and we want to be successful and, you know, famous overnight. We hope that, you know, we start today and by tomorrow or by next week. And of course, anybody who has started any semblance of an online project knows that you probably spend 6 months, 7 months, 8 months, maybe even an entire year, and it's just crickets chirping, nobody paying attention to what you're doing. And you have to be okay with that. And so I think that, you know, there's something to be said for tactics, but often we are over dependent on other people telling us what to do. Mm-hmm. And that's where we lose the ability, I think, to be unmistakable in a lot of ways.
Right. And so you're saying we're taking in too much outside advice?
Well, we're not only taking in too much outside advice, we're too dependent on it. We're too dependent on it to tell us what to do. We seem to think that authority is the end all be all of how we're going to do this thing. So, you know, somebody says, okay, Srini wrote a book, I'm going to follow everything Srini says because that's the only way I'm going to become unmistakable. And there's a mistake in that you're assuming that my word is the final word on this subject.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And it's kind of like rough guidance is one thing, but if it's like a blueprint or a formula, you've missed the whole point.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. I like what you said, too, is that your bliss is different than your calling. And if you could unpack that for people who haven't read your book yet or people who don't understand what that even means, I think that's a really interesting point that people miss constantly. They're going to think that, you know, follow your bliss, or that people are hoping, I really hope I find my calling. I really hope I can figure this out. And maybe you could kind of unpack that.
Yeah. So for example, my bliss is surfing, right? But I'm not going to be a professional surfer because I don't have the skills to be a professional surfer. Not only that, if I took this thing that I enjoy so much and I made it my business, I probably would hate it. It wouldn't be very fun because I don't want to spend my time in the water teaching other people how to surf. I want to spend my time surfing. And so we often, you know, misinterpret those two things. I think another thing we have to be really mindful of is something that I heard in a seminar, and the idea that, you know, your passion should be your business and will lead to your wealth. And that's not necessarily true, because there are things that a lot of people are passionate about, and there's no wealth to be, you know, accumulated from them. There's no business to be made from certain passions. You know, there's situations in which your passion is not going to lead to some sort of a successful business or outcome. You know, Dan Kennedy, who is a, you know, an online marketer and has some amazing material. I mean, he said, you know, businesses have to be market driven. Mm-hmm. They can't be passion driven. So, you know, I think the funniest example he gave was, he said, I like to lie in a hammock. I like to eat pizza. I like to watch football. And he said, no matter how passionate I get about those things, nobody is going to pay me to do them. And yeah, that's true. And right, so right. I think that we have to really be mindful of that. Is what you're offering of value and enough value that somebody is willing to pay for it? So that's something to think about. I think that your bliss can lead to your calling, but your bliss and your calling aren't necessarily one and the same. You know, surfing fuels all of my writing. My calling in life is not to be a surfer. It's to be a writer. Hopefully that helps.
Yeah, that's very good. And so as you mentioned one time, not more than one time, actually, because I've heard it in several places, heard you say this, is that you were fired from all your major jobs or something along those lines. And I was wondering, why you thought that was, if you thought you're just a better entrepreneur than you are an employee, or mm-hmm. why you figured that happened, and then how did you pivot into what is basically where you are now? And I'm sure there were obviously several pivots, but and how did, like, what was the path that kind of led you into just moving into media and into mm-hmm. the podcast, into the book? Because it's an interesting journey. I think there are a lot of people out there, I think mistakenly think, oh, podcasting is what I'll do and then everything will be great. But it's not going to work out for everybody to do that. But it is mm-hmm. your journey is a really interesting one.
Yeah. So as far as the jobs go, I mean, I think I can sum it up with really one simple sentence, is that my talent and my environment were mismatched. My talent is to create things and to make things. Mm. And I was in a lot of roles where I did neither of those things. Mm-hmm. Every job I had was a sales job where I sat around making cold calls all day, which was really, really boring. Mm. And as a creative person, that is really restricting. It's like taking somebody and cutting them off an oxygen supply and wondering why they can't breathe. And so that would be, I think, the big reason. You know, outside of that, I was terrible at those jobs. But there's a reason. That's the reason I was terrible at those jobs, and that's why I got fired from all of them. I think that's really all there is to say about it. Mm-hmm. Of course, the thing that I think forced me to go down this path that I have is the fact that I had been fired from those jobs, because most people are comfortable. And this is something I've said before, but when you're comfortable, there's often no reason to change. Even if you're miserable, you can still be comfortable. That's the really odd paradox, is that you can be miserable and comfortable. And until you're pushed to your breaking point, you're not going to be forced to change in many cases. In fact, most people don't change until something terrible happens or something forces that change. It sounds really nice in theory, and it's nice to read about, it's nice to think about, but until your life circumstances are a kind of, you know, thrown up into the air and a mess is made of them, you aren't really forced to make a change. So when I graduated from business school, I didn't have a job, and it was 2009, which was a really hard time to start a career. So that actually was the beginning of all of this. And so I started a blog that led to this weekly interview series, when eventually we spun it out into a separate site where we interviewed bloggers. And after 3 years, we rebranded it as Unmistakable Creative. And so I think at this point, at the end of this year, it'll be 8 years that we've been doing this. And I got my book deal last year. And so I think that's one thing that people have to keep in mind. You know, if we're talking about what does it really take, longevity is a big one. You know, how much time are you going to put into this thing that you say you're serious about? Because most people give it 90 days. Even a year is not that very long to give one of these things. Or, you know, a year in the world that we live in is not long, even though it seems like it, because people, you know, produce a lot in a year. So that's something that you really have to think about. And then, you know, there's some other aspect of this that is just pure luck. I as much as I hate to say that, yeah, I mean, you know, people have said, you know, luck is when preparation and opportunity meet, which is true. So, you know, for example, you work for 7 years and you produce regularly, your likelihood of getting lucky will go up. It just will. But, you know, there are certain elements of it. You know, there are people who've struggled for years and do not have it. You know, I recently interviewed a performance coach, and he said the harsh reality is that maybe everybody is not this ambitious. Maybe everybody is just they don't have it, and that's a, you know, that maybe that's a pessimistic view. But the thing is, it's you know, we don't want to sell that. We don't want to sell the truth. We want to sell the dream, because the dream keeps people buying, and so. It's one of those things. I mean, we could do an hour discussion of this alone, but I think, you know, you have to really ask yourself, are you the kind of person that can persist at something endlessly and doggedly with a certain sort of stubbornness, despite sort of what the external world might think, and at the same time balance that with enough self-awareness to listen when the external world is telling you something? So it's this very strange sort of, it's a strange combination of ideas.
Mm-hmm. And so going in like year three or year four, are you thinking everything's fine? This is what I had in mind?
Not at all.
Are you thinking, oh crap, this isn't working. Maybe I should give up.
Oh, I mean, even as late as year six, I mean, if you've read the book, you know this. I mean, I even as late as year six, I was thinking this isn't working the way it's supposed to. I should give up. I think that you, I don't think that you ever have a moment of arrival when you think, all right, everything is perfect. I've made it. I'm awesome. You have days, but everybody has days where they also have self-doubt. It's a question of, are you going to let the self-doubt become paralyzing? And most people become paralyzed by whatever nonsense and craziness and whatever story is in their head. And the key is to not let that paralyze you and continue to create your work regardless.
Yeah, I think that the story of persistence, resilience and persistence and dark days helps a lot of people realize that, you know, yes, the book deal came to you. Yes, you have a thriving situation right now, but it wasn't like, well, I knew, you know, because I went to business school, I knew in year eight things were going to, you know, be here. And I think your story is a really interesting one because you're really honest about it. I don't know that people are always going to be terribly honest about their story. They're like, start a blog, be like me, then you'll have a podcast and then you'll be rich and take my workshop. You know, and there's a lot of people kind of selling the get 100,000 subscribers by doing what I did thing. And you kind of know it's a sham, but yet they made it, they make it sound so easy, but you want, you're wondering. So it was never bad for you. You never had a hard time, but I think you're kind of pulling the veil off of that. And you're kind of saying, no, I had a hard time too.
But yeah, everybody does. I mean, some people choose not to expose it.
Yeah.
And I think that once you expose it for what it is, you get a dose of reality. Mm-hmm. Here's the thing, right, is the reason people sell that is because it sells. You know, another thing I heard in this seminar that I was watching, Dan Kennedy meets Werner Erhard, the guy who created the Landmark Forum. And he says, sum up the Landmark thing for me in one sentence. And he said, we sell independence, but we breed dependence. And that's just the truth. That's the harsh truth of what a lot of this is. So another thing, you know, one of my friends recently, a guy named David Berkus, said by the time somebody is telling you that and selling it to you, it's already been done. So therefore, by default, it's not going to work. And what you're paying for really is access to that person, to their ideas. And again, you know, it's not as easy as, hey, follow these steps and you will get the result that I have promised. But the thing is that the reason it sells is because that's exactly what people want. People want a step-by-step blueprint, and they want it to be easy because when they discover that it's hard, they realize that, wait a minute, there's real work that goes into this.
Right, right. And in a way, there's camaraderie just to know that even though it's harder than the step formula, everybody's sort of in it together and we're sort of the same.
I mean, maybe that's the big thing it gives you is community, right? That's what the value of a lot of these courses and things are.
Yeah. And so as you did your own, as you moved more toward media, and how did you transition toward doing more than just podcasting and deciding on how you wanted, like you have animation stuff going on and you have a whole certain look, and how did that develop and how did that evolve?
Mostly by accident, you know, a lot of it through experimentation. So I started out as a writer, not as a podcaster. So I started out with a blog. So writing had always been there as a component. And I never stopped writing throughout. You know, I had a blog for about 2 years while we ran the podcast. And then, you know, I'm a regular contributor at medium.com now. And so the writing thread had always stayed there. All the other stuff was really born out of morbid curiosity more than anything else. My default method of operation just became what would happen if we took this section of our podcast and we animated it, what would happen if we did a custom album cover for every single guest that we interview. So all of these things were part of a very iterative process. It wasn't like I woke up one day and said, I want to do all of these things. I knew from the get-go that I didn't ever want to be limited to doing just one thing. I didn't want to be identified with just one label, because labels are incredibly limiting. So I would say more than anything, it was iteration and experimentation and curiosity that led us to all of this.
Yeah, and I would say your iteration, your model of it anyway, is kind of a, I mean, you could almost mentor people in just that alone, because not a lot of podcasters are necessarily even thinking about stuff like that. They're just they're just thinking about the audio. And people aren't thinking beyond just getting the audio out. And so moving into different, just different aspects and having a more rounded product is kind of something that is unmistakable. It's something that, that is really uniquely yours. And that's what makes it interesting. I think also the guests that you have on are really interesting guests, and they are really unique. And I know you probably, I've heard you say that you don't have like a formula for how you pick your guests, but do you on your own think, something inside you clicks and you think, I have to have this person on? Or in the past, how did you decide? Because you switched from having bloggers on to having more, I don't want to say celebrities, but more well-known people. And how did that evolve?
So a couple of places that came from. One was realizing what stories were truly resonating with people. And we started to look at interviews that were off the charts compared to the other ones. And it was almost never with people who are bloggers or people who talked about building online businesses. What people really liked was the hero's journey. You know, human beings are naturally wired to listen to stories or read stories. If you read a good book, part of what makes a book really appealing is the fact that the narrator is carrying us through his or her hero's journey or carrying us through a character's hero's journey. And so we effectively took that and applied it to podcasting because we saw when that was the kind of story that we told, the impact on the audience was much more significant. And so we moved away from being a show about interviewing bloggers, asking about tactics, to telling those kinds of stories, which is why you get to do the kinds of things like translate these stories into animated shorts. So I don't, you know, nobody, I've, you know, sometimes a guest will tell me that, hey, these are the questions that I have been asked, and I say, that's great, I'm not going to ask you any of those. And yeah, I never send anybody a list of questions beforehand. So you asked about the formula and the fact that I've said that there is no formula. And this is true. There is no formula. So, for example, recently a woman emailed me and said, what is the criteria? And it's a hard question to answer because there is no criteria. That doesn't mean I don't have standards. In fact, the standards are ruthless. But there's no list of things that you could check off for me to say yes. And that's really what it is. More than anything, it's, am I curious about this? Do I feel that it will be valuable? So, you know, how do you know, how can you possibly put on your list of things to do make Srini curious? There's no formula for make Srini curious. There's no equation that you could do. There's no number of things you could do. There's no tactics you could follow. There is nothing you could do that would guarantee that. And so that's one, is my own personal curiosity. The other is, will this be entertaining? Entertaining is critically important because we're a storytelling show first. You know, we tell stories that happen to have teaching built into them. And then, can you educate? So it's a combination of both education and entertainment. If you can do one but not the other, then it's almost always a no.
Now, do you get approached then? Like, tell my story?
I do.
Yeah.
I do.
And does that work?
Sometimes I say yes, sometimes I say no. Like I said, it really depends. It just depends on whether I think the story is worth telling or not, or whether it piques my curiosity. And so it's hard for me to boil it down into some sort of formula.
Yeah. Well, that's actually a formula. The non-formula is a formula then, I guess. But yeah, I've always been, that keeps people coming back too, because when I'm looking on my phone and I'm like, who could be next? Who knows? You know, when I'm looking to see who your guest is, it could be anybody. And that's actually the fun of it. And the surprise is the fun of it. And so that's part of the anticipation, is part of what I like about your show. And so do you see anything around the bend that is new or is a pivot for you coming up besides the book?
At the moment, no. I mean, so I'm doing a lot more speaking, but I think, you know, we're kind of at the place where we have built a foundation. Now it's just time to sort of expand on the foundation that we've built.
Yeah. And you do speaking, but and obviously you have the book that you're running with now and speaking, but do you see that maybe you're going to do anything in terms of like an event? A lot of people kind of brought into that, but
at the moment, no. I mean, maybe down the road, but at the moment, no.
Yeah. This is really cool. And so what do you think is the most valuable thing that your book has to offer people that is unmistakable?
Well, I think the biggest thing is looking at the value of getting away from following a map or following a predetermined set of instructions. In a world that's incredibly uncertain, a predetermined outcome or a predetermined solution that leads to a predetermined outcome, the value of that is rapidly going down. And so that's what I would say, is that I think we're more and more moving to a point where the future, as I've said, really belongs to people who have managed to become unmistakable. It's, again, you know, I guess you ask what is the criteria for a guest on our show? Is this unmistakable? Is this something that only they could have done? And so I think the real value in the book is helping people uncover what that is for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we live in really uncertain times in so many ways, and I think people are hoping for that, for the easier answers, and they want to be handed something that's more simple. But when you're living in such uncertain times, you do have to strike it out on your own. Mm-hmm. And you can't be expecting that it's just going to be really that clear cut. But to know that that's the road you took, and that's the road that a lot of people are finding more fulfilling. Mm-hmm. More fulfilling calling and more success in ways that aren't cookie cutter, I think is an important message.
Definitely.
And so do you find that are people who are reading the book getting back to you and saying, this is a book, stick to podcasting, or write more?
The thing is, I didn't write the entire time I was doing a podcast, so people are very familiar with
the
fact that I'm a writer.
Right,
yeah, they know that I'm a writer, so mm-hmm. so no, not necessarily.
Yeah, and if you're going to be writing more, if you're going to be writing another book, do you think it would be kind of like, I think about Seth Godin, and he writes, you know, he writes all the time, and he has a blog all the time, and he's always writing books and stuff too. And he'll kind of pivot a lot, but in a way it's sort of all in kind of the same vein. And I was wondering if you think of yourself writing in a similar vein as well.
Well, I mean, my next book is going to be a bit different, because it's going to be about creative habits more than anything else, and probably a bit more practical in terms of be able to give you sort of more hands-on stuff. So no, I don't know that it'll necessarily be the same vein. It's hard to say. I mean, again, I think, you know, you become known for something. Mm-hmm. At the core, I think all of my books will probably center around the theme of creativity in one way or another. That's what I would say for that.
Yeah. Well, this has been really fun. Can you let everybody know where the best places are to find you on the socials and on your website?
So unmistakablecreative.com is our website. And then facebook.com/SriniRao. My personal Facebook is probably the most active of our presences.
Okay. Sounds great. Thank you so much for sharing some of your time with me. And I look forward to finishing up your book. And I love the podcast. So thank you so much for producing that.
Yeah. Thank you.
Show notes for this episode can be found at sparkmymuse.com. There you'll find details for websites and people and books mentioned in this episode, and sometimes you'll find photos and videos too. Please stop by and check it out.